Is this John?
This Henry.
Oh, Henry, this is Dave.
Hi, Dave.
Look, the generals out here, right? You have a hard time controlling them, right?
I don't control them, no.
Okay. Well, look, we have done everything we can to be able to communicate in a nice, passionate way. We've, told you what our work with God is. And, we've been kind. We've not been your everyday kind of cult. We've not been your everyday kind of terrorist, which I'm sure you're familiar with having to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of things that the FBI or these generals are doing is just kind of way beyond the scope of reason. And they're not only destroying private property, they're also removing evidences. And this doesn't seem like that these are moves that should be made by a government who says to a people that we're going to be able to take this up in a court of law.
History on the dark side. We're back. The siege continues, and Henry back.
Siege begins.
Yeah, it didn't really begin. They did a raid. Now that's over. Yeah. But we got Henry back. Hi, Henry.
What's up?
How are you?
Happy to be here. I'm excited to talk about what I find to be the most interesting part of Waco, which is the siege.
Well, I'm excited to talk about your headband, so we're going to start there.
Thanks. I like it.
For those of you that are listening at home, Henry has a headband.
It's purple and floral.
Is it an actual, folded-up bandana, or is it just a headband?
No, it's some weird headband thing I stole from my mom.
I like it. Nice. I like it.
Yeah.
Jacob does not have a headband.
No.
This is why I had more sons. If at first you don't succeed.
Honestly, headbands are kind of underrated. I'm super down with that.
I thought you were about to talk trash on headbands.
No, not at all, actually. More times than I would like to admit, I have thought to myself, dang, I don't have any good headbands.
No, seriously.
That's happened several times in my life.
It was funny, when we were in Phoenix for debate nationals, when I wore this headband, and one of the kids looked at me and was like, where did you come up with that idea? And I was just like,
to wear a headband?
Dude, hippies have been doing this for decades.
Yeah, for real.
Century. this is, thank you for the vote of confidence, but I promise this is not my idea.
I have a six pack of black athletic headbands that I got so when I work out, I don't get sweat in my eyes.
Right.
They're all like new.
Nice.
They have not seen much use.
Perfect for the show.
The cool thing, when I get athletic gear, it lasts forever, dude. No warranty required. Oh, how's your week? Anybody?
That's pretty good.
Anything exciting? There's your chance to get it out before we start for real.
Nah, man.
All right.
I've just been thinking long and hard about the best part of Waco, the news.
Oh, that's right! You're fired up for the news. So.
Finally.
You're in this time.
What about you, Jared? Anything exciting in your life?
Another week of summer school in the books.
Hey, yo.
Oh, yeah.
My first week as a professor, actually doing, professor things, so that was exciting.
That's dope.
Now I'm underpaid at two economic levels as a public school teacher and
hell
a
yeah.
college professor. But you know what? In this world, you get paid what you're worth. So if you don't like it, do something about it, and I'm not. So I guess I'm getting paid exactly what I'm worth. No, it's cool. It's weird to have a totally online class. When we did that with COVID for the middle school, you'd already seen the kids before, so you kind of had that recognition of who's who. But in my college class, most of them don't even use a picture or even an avatar in their school-wide communications is just a name, so that's a little different vibe.
And, student number 13.
Student number 13, doing great. Good job, 13.
Woo!
All right. Well, let's talk FBI, shall we?
I would love to. Nothing would make me happier than to talk about the FBI.
So we have the attempted serving of the search warrant, which goes poorly. We have the shootout, which, I mean, I guess it goes poorly whenever people get shot, right?
Yeah, so, I would say that's definitely a not great situation.
We have 4 dead ATF agents. We've got 6 dead Branch Davidians.
As well as a handful others injured.
Yeah, and we got a big old mess that is not at all a secret.
But don't worry, because the FBI's here now.
They are. It's
they're here to save the day.
Well, you know, they're in because we've had other agencies involved in the shootout. As soon as the first ATF agent died, if it wasn't any other way to tie him in before, it became FBI jurisdiction. I think we talked about that. Mm-hmm. I did a little extra research thinking about what is the history of FBI standoffs, because I know quite a bit about Ruby Ridge, but I had forgotten that in 1973 we had a standoff with the Pine Ridge Lakota Indians at Wounded Knee. They kind of did an Occupy thing at Wounded Knee.
Really?
To protest some of the policies in that time era. I mean, newsflash, spoiler alert. The American government has almost never had a good relationship with Native Americans.
Weird.
Right? So shockingly, in the 70s, that's still true.
Crazy.
And
did that end poorly? Did that end violently?
It did. It did. The kind of tribal spat overflowed. It was really kind of the birth of the AIM movement, which is a big Native American rights thing. And mm-hmm. So they occupied Wounded Knee. And that one's tricky because it's not technically the FBI's problem. That's Bureau of Indian Affairs.
Right.
And they hadn't really had armed conflict with Native Americans in, you know, almost a century. And back then, they would just kill everybody because that was kind of... In fact, that's what happened at Wounded Knee.
Right.
So, good job, America. When they took this over, there was a lengthy standoff. And something that occurred to me today... And I kind of refreshed myself about Wounded Knee because we were talking about that in summer school. And I went, oh, connection. Mm-hmm. That, you know, the training that the FBI has to deal with these sieges is pretty much centered on hostages. The team that gets brought in at Ruby Ridge and Waco, that's the hostage rescue team.
Oh, yeah, the HRT.
But in Wounded Knee, there's not really hostages. The people who went there wanted to be there. Right. Nobody's being held there against their will. We saw the same thing with the Weaver family and friend. They're not there against their will. They chose to be there. And here again in Waco, I think this is... I mean, it's a little blurrier because there's kids involved, right? But they make it sound like it's a big... The media... that it's a big hostage crisis at times, but and anytime anybody leaves the compound, they talk about hostages being released.
Right.
I don't know how accurate that is, because I've gotten the impression that if you were in Waco and you wanted out, you just left.
Right.
Even during this siege.
And people were allowed to leave. Yeah, it's interesting, like, the FBI puts a lot of emphasis on hostage negotiation, especially during this time period. And I think it's just interesting because that the FBI didn't really step away. I don't know what the FBI does now, but you know, during the 70s, 80s, 90s is sort of when the FBI themselves are having that sort of renaissance where they are starting to recognize, you know, how mental health can actually interplay into these situations. And so maybe, like, to me, the FBI's sort of go-to being HRT kind of just reads as like I don't know, a relic of an older age, right? Like, that they just assume, oh, okay, we've got a situation, people are being held down, there's going to be hostages, let's take care of them, right? When, in reality, in a lot of situations, like you mentioned, there's not really any reason to believe that. Mm-hmm. Especially at Waco, right? Like, I think maybe the hostages at Waco were the children, right? Especially because, you know, the news at the time was talking about how kids are being, you know, sort of held hostage there, but...
And by the end, most of the kids left at Waco are direct descendants of David Koresh, or his kids.
Right.
So now it's an even blurrier subject, because if you're the family of the people being tried to get drug out of there,
right,
a little harder to say you're a hostage, even though clearly, I'm not trying to say if you're a kid, you don't get to pick. You're not picking these things. But you're also, I mean, are you in any kind of danger, right? Like, the thing with hostages is we want to protect them. We want to make sure they're not hurt. We value the success or failure of operations on our hostages hurt. Mm-hmm. But with the Wounded Knee, with Ruby Ridge, with Waco, was there ever really a threat that any of those people were going to be hurt by the, quote, you know, hostage taker?
I don't think there was. Like, going back, obviously I wasn't born when this happened, so all of my perspectives on this are sort of retrospective. But going back and reading articles that were released in 1993, like, while this situation is unfolding, you know, most of the stories are very aggressive and specific in their language about what David Koresh is, what his beliefs are, and they make a lot of these sort of grandiose claims of how violent a man he is.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
So...
Well, he's got all those guns. He's obviously violent.
Right, exactly. So, to me, looking at the situation, I don't think that there was a threat that he... I don't believe that there was a threat of mass suicide, but I also don't believe that there was a threat against anyone in that facility except for the external threat that comes from the conflict between FBI and Koresh. Okay. I think that's the only threat that was held against them. But that's just me personally.
So I had looked up, not for this podcast, but just for some other nerdy master's degree research, you know, what was the written, stated policy of the FBI at this time frame? And that was not me trying to prove a point. This was me being very curious. Mm-hmm. You know, what rule book do they have? So, and I think it's important that this is from 78. So this is stuff that should have been in place for a while.
Right.
And should have had time to be accepted as this is how we're going to do things. And a couple key things that the policy states. Whenever something is escalated, it's extremely hard to come back from. Mm-hmm. So de-escalation's a key tenet, and not moving anything forward to add to anxiety and then thinking you can just take it away and get back to where you were. Another big one was time. This is probably the most important one. According to FBI policy, time is considered a benefit to the negotiations. The longer something goes on, and this is based on, you know, field work and studies and numbers, the longer something goes on, the more likely you are to have, quote, hostages become released or to end the matter safely.
To a peaceful resolution.
And then...
That's interesting.
Right, right. Another thing that's going to, I think, become huge, because you had just talked about we've got this conflict between the FBI and the Davidians, mm-hmm. and I'm going to suggest we have at least four parties in conflict. The FBI has conflict with themselves because we have a negotiating team that is supposed to, per their policy, be given precedence, be given paramount importance. It's their baby until they say it's not.
Right.
Or until some other extenuating circumstance means that the risk to the hostages by continuing the negotiations outweighs we go hard and stuff happens.
Right.
So you have the negotiating team that believes that is the principles that they're operating under. And establishing and creating trust is key to them doing their mission. Then we have the HRT team, the tactical side. And their job, by definition, is the oh crap button. If things go bad and we have to go, how can we get in there in the fastest way possible to protect as many people as possible?
Right.
Okay? So we have those two very diametrically opposed views of what to do within the FBI.
Definitely.
And that can work so long as one side is clearly in charge and not being undercut by the other, whichever way that breaks.
Which?
We're going to revisit that.
That goes well.
The third party is obviously the Davidians. Mm. Fourth party, Jacob. Who's the other big player in this whole thing?
The media?
Well, there you go. You made it. The media.
Ding, ding, ding.
I wanted to take a note on kind of how you're talking about, you know, these different parties. It's like the FBI shows up because an ATF agent gets shot, which, like, the ATF, they framed it all as a hostage thing, right? They framed it all as, we're going to go in and save these kids.
Gotta save the kids.
But as soon as the ATF agent gets shot, you would think that's like the cue for FBI's tactical to be like, okay, we have the go-ahead. But as soon as FBI arrives on scene, then you realize, oh, it's not actually for tactical. It's going to be for hostage. And so, like, that whole, you know, clash between all these different parties, that kind of makes a lot of sense why there's a lot of, people working against each other, even within the FBI, because tactical thinks that they should be running in and storming the place, and the hostage, HRT, is trying to, you know, not do that.
Right.
Well, the HRT is tactical. That's all the same. We got the negotiations, HRT. But yes, on to your point. You're right on the point. And, you know, part of that is the FBI is not sitting there with their full forces ready the moment the raid goes bad, because they're assuming it won't go bad.
Right.
There's no reason for them to even think about what the ATF's doing until it goes bad.
Yeah.
So it takes them a little bit of time to get up and running on both sides of this, but I guarantee you, you can get the negotiations up and running quicker because you just need a guy.
Yeah.
Than you can the tactical side.
But whatever guy they send in, he's not going to be there before the news trucks. They're already there.
That's the big part, right? Just like we're going to bring in all this additional resources from the government. If you didn't care about this little town in Texas before, the second there's a shootout and American, you know, ATF agents die, it's on.
Yep.
I think, I don't know what Ruby Ridge was as a national level story, because it wasn't as quick. There was national coverage. Mm-hmm. I remember hearing about it in real time as a kid, so that's, you know, it happened. That's all real. But I don't recall it being a big story. It didn't dominate the news in Sacramento, California.
Right. No.
It was just kind of a little thing.
I think it was probably more of a local phenomena than anything, right? But then once we have, obviously once Waco wraps up, then we realize why Ruby Ridge is so critical.
Sure, sure.
Right? Yeah. Like what, you know, I think we learn more from Ruby Ridge now than we did at the time, maybe.
Definitely.
Right?
Definitely. And there's a lot unsettled with Ruby Ridge. Like, you know, the Weavers get some settlement money for wrongful death, basically, for Vicky and the baby. But that doesn't happen yet. Mm-hmm. At the time Waco happenings, that I don't even know if that litigation piece has even started yet.
Wow.
It'll be a couple years after Waco before that happens. So we don't even look at Ruby Ridge as a cautionary tale. It's still up in the air. We just don't really know the facts, even the people who did get that. And you got to look at where was Ruby Ridge. That's way up in these mountains next to the Canadian border. There's only so much news crew you can drag up there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Waco, Texas, nice and flat.
Right in the
highways aren't that far.
Yep.
Major University, Baylor nearby. So the satellite trucks, are coming. Mm-hmm. And the FBI is going to set up their border. Their crime scene is about 2 miles away. So they've got a 2-mile buffer. And the media is like, okay, you're keeping us this far away, so we can't see nothing. Hold my beer. They go nuts. I mean, you've got technology, right? So you've got long-range lenses and all that. But they erect, like, this big viewing tower, like this scaffolding system, so they can put people up there to see what's new, what's going on.
Seriously?
Run some of the... They built this... It's like a... When you go to the people who judge a parade and you go by the grandstands, they built the grandstands, basically, to get up above the tree line to get the best view possible of what was going on there.
It becomes a spectator sport, honestly.
It does.
And like, there's active news coverage. People are there wanting to know, you know, second-by-second details. And the second that anything happens, someone leaves the house, someone enters the house, it is print and published in no time at all.
And you're not getting any additional resources to the site without the news seeing it.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. There's nowhere to hide.
There's only one road in and out.
Right, right. So you know when more stuff's coming.
Right.
Hey, look, here comes armored personnel carriers. Here comes an M1A1 Abrams tank. Yeah, not sneaking out by anybody.
It's like the news got into reality TV.
And I wonder, and I didn't find in the research I did, but I didn't really think of the question until right now. I wonder what they did for the airspace. Because I'm sure they blocked it off. And I don't have a problem with that because they have weapons that could reach that stuff.
Absolutely.
But if Waco happened today, you'd have 100 guys out there with drones, and the footage would be completely different.
Yeah.
Like,
we would have a lot more information on how things went down instead of just...
You just had helicopters, really, to do that kind of work in the time. And you're able, I think, to effectively keep those at bay enough. But as much as the coverage is wall-to-wall, it would have been even bigger.
Yeah, absolutely.
Today, a lot bigger. So we're going to set up the perimeter. The news media are going to come in. And you also have that time frame because, hey, you know, when there was Ruby Ridge, or I'm sorry, not Ruby Ridge. When you had Wounded Knee, the news was on at 6 o'clock. Walter Cronkite told you what you needed to hear. At 6:30, it moved on. And you got your, 6:30 is local, 6:30 to 7's. The big time, that was your news for the day. They published something in the paper.
Mm-hmm.
But by the time we get to good old Waco, guess what we got, Jaco? Okay. I made a rhyme right there. Yeah, we got CNN. We've got the early instances of wall-to-wall, all-day-long cable news.
It's the burgeoning point of the 24-hour news cycle.
And if you're a cable news service... You can offer something the networks can't because those minute-by-minute updates you talked about, you're the one giving it to them.
Yep.
They can't interrupt all my children in General Hospital every day to update the moves. But I'm sorry, if you're fans of Days of Our Lives, I didn't mean to leave you out there. Anyway, but the cable news, they can just run it and make this a story. And what's going to be a bigger story than that? We've got kids in danger, we've got guns, we've got people hurt, we've got religion. This is made for America.
It's everything. It's a bingo tanks. Card.
It's the yeah, it's the perfect storm. It is a bingo card. Good one. So that's where the news media is.
Mm-hmm.
And their goal in all this is not the truth. That's never the goal with the news anymore. It's just the story.
Yeah.
And so anything that goes on to make that story bigger is going to help. And they'll have daily news conferences. And, you know, I think it's very early in that process that the news media is pushing this narrative around and basically making the FBI. It's easy to make Koresh look like a psycho, right? Like,
absolutely. I mean, it was happening before Waco even began.
But as soon as you're having a daily news conference of how it looks like you can't get anything done, it's pretty easy to make you look ineffective, too.
Yeah, that's true.
And if I can make the government look flustered on the news conference, my ratings will go up.
Yep. Yeah.
So we've got some gamesmanship that's going to happen there, and that's a whole thing.
Right.
All right, where'd my timeline go?
So we get into March.
March! Okay, so March 1's the first day of the, quote, siege, right?
Yeah, I think it's, you know, very nice of them to have the raid on the last day of February.
Yeah, let's just start clean at the start of the month.
Makes things very nice.
Okay, right off the bat. So we've got early negotiations, and 10 kids come out March 1st.
Mm-hmm. Day one, huge success.
Already. Day one, yes, yes. If you're the FBI, you're feeling good.
Yeah, 24 mm-hmm. hours, you've got negotiations in there, making progress. Mm-hmm. But then at the same time, the FBI is bringing in more armor, right?
They are.
So kind of a contradictory action there, right?
Sure, but I think the bigger issue will be, is it getting used? Like, you can bring in whatever you want. As long as we're still talking and you're doing what you say, I don't care what you bring in. I'm going to trust you till I don't. So that's kind of my thought of that.
I mean, I see that. But to me, you know, if, you know, from Koresh's perspective, he's got this huge situation that's blown up out of nowhere, right? He's complying, negotiating. He's scared, right? You can hear that when he makes the phone call to the sheriff the day before.
Right.
Right? He's obviously in a very tough situation. So then to me, like, if he's complying and negotiating, and then all of a sudden more armored vehicles are arriving, more men, right, more weapons, does that, to me, that would sort of show a contradictory message from the FBI, right? Because if he's listening, if he's complying, if he's following along, what's the need for more armor, right? But that's just me. I can see why the FBI would have brought in more armor. I can see, you know, why they would have made the decisions they did, but it doesn't mean I agree with them.
The way that I kind of saw that is that, like, David Koresh knew he was going to dig his heels in, he was going to hang out for some time, you know? Mm-hmm. And shots had already been fired on both sides, and so I think that it made the most sense for him to be like, hey, there's probably going to be more gunfire at some point. And so let's get these kids out of here. You know, the last thing anybody wants is to hurt kids, you know? Yeah.
Right.
And so I thought that that was him getting the kids out so that way he can dig his heels in and be ready for what's coming because he knows there's going to be more.
Right. It's inevitable.
All right. The next day, day two of the siege here, mm-hmm. two elderly women come out of Waco.
Woo woo.
So we've had, quote, hostages being released.
Heavy quotations.
2 days in a row. I don't even know that there were specific conditions negotiated for either of those yet. I think this was very basic. Hey, let's get people out. Let's get older, sick, hurt people out. What can we do to just establish this floor of a relationship?
Yeah.
And in, you know, a situation we're going to negotiate, you got to remember that on the one side, we've got Koresh. And he does have, you know, his, like, top aide, Schneider is his name. Mm-hmm. So those are the guys you're going to be talking to on that side. You want to have as few people as possible on the FBI side.
Yeah, you want to have one person who you can
trust. Because if it's consistent, exactly. Because you don't build trust with the FBI, you build trust with a person.
Someone who happens to work for the FBI.
Yeah.
Right, which is why negotiations are so key, because it creates a personal bond with the people afflicted so that you can come to an actual resolution, one that's, you know, sort of subjective and fair rather than just sort of objectively the situation is done, right? Which is sort of what the tactical response would be.
Right. And it makes it, it puts the humanity back in this, holy cow, we just had a war.
Yeah.
And now we're backing out of that and we're having a human interaction again, which should be a good thing.
It should be. With, you know, the FBI's whole kind of shtick is the FBI takes over situations that have already gone bad, so they should want the best resolution, but, you know, as this situation plays on, it seems like the FBI feels like they need the quickest solution instead.
Well, and that'll come. There's definitely a quickening, right?
Yeah.
So we go a couple more days. There's long negotiations. On March 4th, they bring in the profilers.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we all know them. You know, FBI profiling, we think of mostly with like serial killers and mind hunters and all that.
Yeah.
So the FBI's profilers come in and say that in this situation, based on how they're reading David Koresh, it would be counterproductive and lead to loss of life, likely, if you increase pressure on him.
Weird.
This.
Right? Who'd have thought?
But this is one of those, if you have experts and they're your experts,
you trained, you
you
paid.
Might consider listening to your experts.
Yeah. It's, it's just, I mean, not to keep foreshadowing, but just as this goes on, knowing how the FBI is handling the situation, how they have all the right cards in their hand, right? And yet they just, as days go on, they just keep making weird bets, right?
Yeah.
They keep betting on a river that's never going to show. So it's, I don't know. But with bringing in profilers and having at least some sort of plan of like, okay, here's who Koresh is. Here's our general understanding of him. You know, from here, it would make sense that they just continue going on that advice, right? Try and make progress,
right,
based off of what the profilers have done. So far, 4 days into this siege, FBI is doing great.
It seems that way.
Right.
Your tactical team's putting together stuff. We haven't talked a lot about them because they're getting gathered up. They don't have a role really right here.
Yeah, they're just they're the safety blanket, right? They're the umbrella.
And they've probably got an early plan figured out. Mm-hmm. Okay, if this goes crap, here's how we go hard to try and stop it. I imagine that's been, at least in the big brushstrokes, figured out by them.
Right.
The problem is the negotiators, right? Their number one friend is time.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
They're trained to take time.
They need that time.
Time's a tool to them. On the tactical side of things, time's a danger.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because the longer you have a bunch of people geeked up and ready to go,
the more likely
they are to make a mistake, to overreact, to do something. You need to get them at that fever pitch right at the right moment and let them unleash. So time has a very diverse and adverse effects on the two different groups, you know?
Yep.
And we're going to start to see that. I think this is the first point coming up where all of a sudden the tactical side can go, wait a minute, this is starting to look like a nail and we're a hammer. So on the 5th, and I didn't write this down in my notes, so I think more than one kid came out on the 5th. But one of the kids who did come out, they found, because they're searching them as they come out, they're making sure they don't have stuff on them.
Right.
They find a note that has been pinned on the inside of this kid's jacket or shirt or something. Supposed to be from his parents, his mom. And this note says, once all the kids leave, then the adults are going to die.
Whoa.
Okay.
That's a
game changer.
Yeah.
I don't know why you would assume that's fake, right? It's like the 9-year-old, I'm going to write this. I'm going to pin it back here. I'll teach these pigs.
Yeah.
I don't think that's a thing.
I think there's also the argument to be made of like, well, what makes them say that, right? Like, what's spurring that? So I think, whether it's fake or whether it's not, at the very least, the FBI is confused by it.
Oh, yeah.
And I think it shows a division. The Branch Davidians are not all the same, homogenous in how they're looking at this situation, which makes sense. You would think there'd be differences of opinion inside.
Right.
I know there is, because when you talk to some of the few survivors, right, they're all over the board. Mm-hmm. From crazy, I wish I was still there, David Koresh is Jesus, to, man, there was a lot going on, but he wasn't doing this or that,
right.
to, yeah, that's pretty much how it was. It's all over the board, so.
It's hard to know, even, you know, however many decades later, you know, it's hard to know what Koresh was actually wanting from the situation.
And there's no reason to think that if there's 100 people inside, all of the adults are getting the same access to information.
Absolutely.
That doesn't happen in most organizations. Some people know more.
Especially religious organizations.
Yeah, and right? a lot there's, of times that's structured that way.
Exactly. It's purposely built that way, and the people who are, you know, sort of subordinate, the people who are beneath, they're okay with that.
Right.
They feel right. like they can put the trust in the people who are leading them. Sorry, this is just reminding me a lot of government. This is... anyway.
Yeah, well, there's some similarities there.
So there's...
They both... never mind. I was going to say something I was going to regret.
Yeah, that's all right.
It was going to be true, but I was going to regret it.
That's life.
Okay.
So after the note, we... lost my train of thought?
Well, after the note, we get some... we overhear some conversation the FBI does, whether that's while Schneider and Koresh are talking on the phone or whether that's listening devices or whatever, because they've put some stuff in and around that place.
Mm. Well, they've also the milk crates and stuff, right? The FBI negotiators have set a plan in place of they're going to bring milk in, fresh milk, to give to the Davidians so that they can keep surviving.
Well, that's gonna come up here in another couple days. That really starts to hit off.
Oh, okay.
They may have already been bringing some food supplies. Mm. It's not a point that matters just yet.
Well, they did bug the crates.
But however, they hear that Koresh is worried the FBI is going to burn this place down so that there's no evidence to prove them right, I guess. Like, he's worried... And I don't know, is this Armageddon religious talk? Is he teaching, or is he like, dude, now that this shootout happened, there's no way they're letting us out alive.
Right.
And they're going to torch this place, and they're never going to talk about it again. That's probably a reasonable fear.
It is. I think going to the extent of him worrying about them burning down the place, right, I think that is... It maybe shows how sort of... existential Koresh is thinking, right? It's always he's interpreting a situation to its fullest extent.
Or maybe that's him planting this seed because he already knows he's going to make sure this place burns down.
Or to make
and
it
this
more
is going to make it their fault.
Maybe he genuinely believed it in this moment, but then he plants the seed for himself that doesn't come into play for a month or so later.
Yeah, that we just had an Inception moment.
Weird.
For real.
If Nolan makes a Waco movie, I'm in. Like, I can't wait to see Oppenheimer.
I expect a cut.
But, yeah.
Oppenheimer is going to be sick.
I'm looking forward to that. Okay, so now we get to our milk crisis. We've got a... The FBI had been sending milk.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe they're bugging the crates. I don't know. There's nothing that suggests the Davidians have figured that out. Then, a couple days later, they decide they're going to stop delivering milk until less more kids come out. So, to me, it's important. We've had several people come out. It has been a couple days.
Right.
But Koresh asked. He hasn't really asked for much, frankly. He's like, can you send us the milk for the kids? The babies need milk, whole milk, whatever.
And he asks for the milk, and then he asks for the national broadcast.
Right.
But that's really his only two demanding points.
And as I recall, those weren't connected. It wasn't like, hey, do this and give me the milk and I'll do that. It was like, these are the two things I need. This for these kids, this for my cause, whatever. They do both, right?
Mm-hmm.
They get him his time. He gets to present his message. That must have been interesting. You're going around to the networks like, hey, this guy says he will... he'll give up if somebody broadcasts this stuff. I'm sure NBC's like, yeah, hard pass on that. But the Christian Broadcasting Network, I'm going to tip my hat to them.
They snatch it up?
They say they'll do it. So that's... There's certainly... Nobody on that network thinks of Koresh as a mainstream religious preacher.
Absolutely.
He's a little borderline for those folks. So, you know, good on them for being willing to take that chance.
Taking one for the team.
Yeah, cool. But so they're going to stop delivering the milk.
That's interesting to me that the FBI would willingly stop with the bugging of the crates. Because I, reading back through the transcriptions of when they bug the crates, there's an interesting moment where there's once the negotiations have started, there's a quote from Schneider, Crush's second, where he's talking about, forgetting the negotiator's specific name, but where he's talking about how he really feels like he's connected with this negotiator, talking about he's a good man, he's a good person, and how Schneider felt like the negotiators from the FBI wanted a peaceful and proper resolution.
Absolutely. Right. Yeah.
So the
it seemed like they were vibing.
Right. So the bugs are giving them crucial information of, okay, negotiations are working, right? We just need to keep going.
And it seems to me that this plan, stop sending the milk, was not the negotiator's plan.
Absolutely. This feels like
this was a somebody up above override, because you got, now we're a week in and this HRT team is losing their mind. Because we've been ready to go hard for a week now.
Yeah.
Now, I don't get to go home. I missed a weekend with my kids. This just got serious. Jimmy had a soccer game. So we've got that. Later on, and this is even dumber to me, like, they send the milk. They repent from this, right? They go, okay, well, we're going to resend the milk. But you've already done the damage because you took it away. And then, like, the next day, they turn off the power. Like, the milk isn't any good if it spoils.
Yeah.
So you're going to send milk, allegedly, for the children. That's why you sent it. And then you're going to turn off the power so it spoils and goes bad. To me, that's a huge mixed message.
Absolutely.
And I would be angry. And how does, you know, Koresh respond anytime they escalate or go off the negotiation tactic?
Not positively, surprisingly. I mean, it's crazy. You keep pushing him further and further into a corner. He's, you know, he's going to feel like his wheels are just spinning further, deeper and deeper into the mud. Mm-hmm. Right? But that's when you get people kind of acting on impulse instead of acting on logical decisions.
His most common reaction, though, is he just stops talking to him.
Yeah. Yep.
Like, I was negotiating, you did this, so okay.
Yep.
I guess we'll wait longer.
And it's, you know, Koresh has nothing but time, right? They have, what was it, like a year's worth of food?
They think they have a year's worth of food. They don't have that, they're not sure how their water situation is.
Right.
Because in the initial gunfight, a lot of the water tanks got shot up. Not by the Davidians.
Oh, mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, the water tanks attacked the ATF.
Yeah.
So they put holes in them.
The dog was in front of the water tank.
And they're not sure what's left in there, what kind of water situation they have anywhere else.
Right.
It's not something that's come up. Koresh isn't saying, hey, we need water. Mm-hmm. But they know from... you know, eyewitnesses and whatever, and they can check receipts of stuff they've got. They think they've got about a year's supply of, like, MREs and foodstuffs.
Okay.
That's a long time.
It is a long time.
And I'm
especially
sure
in the FBI world.
The FBI is not trying to have that go down.
And I think that's one of the first, you know, as this gets longer and longer and the FBI starts to make more and more kind of tactical decisions, I think this is where I find it important to note about how, you know, the FBI on paper, like you were reading earlier, says time is crucial in negotiations, right? But then in this actual...
Time is the tool.
Right, it's key for, you know, time heals all wounds, all that stuff. But then in an actual practical situation, the FBI is kind of going back on that, right? Like, it feels like the FBI is getting impatient. And to me, I think the amount of news pressure that exists here, I think it's unprecedented for the FBI, right? Because, like, there were events like Wounded Knee, like Ruby Ridge, where there is national coverage, but to me, like, Waco is, correct me if I'm wrong, but it's the first big, like, spectacle.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. There's...
And so I think the FBI is sort of in this situation where they're like, okay, we need to get this over with. We need to get it over with. We need it done. And so some of these decisions... You know, some of these mixed messages, they just start to escalate, right? They just start to become more frequent. And so, no wonder the Davidians don't want to talk anymore, right? No wonder Koresh is starting to pull the trigger on that.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead, Jake.
Well, it kind of... It feels like the media has flipped the script on this entire situation. You know, normally the negotiators want to take their time, and they're worried that, you know, the people inside are going to get antsy and do something stupid and mess up.
Mm-hmm.
But now with all this media scrutiny, it feels like David Koresh is just taking his time. He'll just stop talking because he knows he can wait it out for a year.
Right.
And then all of a sudden the FBI starts getting antsy and they cut the power.
Yep.
And, you know, to me, someone who's lived through both, right? The media coverage of Waco reminds me of a primitive version of 9/11 coverage.
Hmm.
It was similar. I mean, on 9/11, you couldn't hear anything but that.
Right.
Okay. And the technology wasn't there. There wasn't 100 cable news stations. There wasn't mass media apps and all that. But, you know, social media. But this was like the baby version. I think there's more similarities, more of a precursor of 9/11 coverage than anything else. And a couple reasons for that. One, in the beginning, they don't shut off the phone line, okay? They don't do the negotiator thing where the only outline is to the negotiator.
Mm-hmm.
So for the first like week or so, David Koresh has a phone that works, and he picks that thing up, and he starts calling CNN. He calls news services. He gets out his version of events, and the FBI is just like, crap!
Yeah, exactly. It's unprecedented. Like, the FBI is just, they're in a spot.
And, you know, one of the big things is the narrative that it's about the children has been huge. What is it that they're saving the children from?
This from the child molester.
From Koresh.
Yeah. Right.
Who is shot.
Yep.
And they've got video evidence of him laying around shot. He ain't gonna be molesting nobody for a while. He's right. Jacked up.
Yep.
So the direct threat, and that's all gonna come another, you know, 3 weeks down the line when we get to Reno and Clinton.
Mm-hmm.
But that direct, we have to do something now to save these children. That's not real.
Mm-hmm.
That threat isn't real.
Yep.
It doesn't mean that there wasn't abuse that already happened. It doesn't mean that there might not have been, probably would have been, continued abuse like that
right.
later on. But while things are going on in Waco, I can't imagine there's any abuse or even a realistic threat of it. Because this wasn't the whole place molesting children.
Right.
It's Koresh.
And especially, you know, at this point, Koresh sends out the message where he says, all right, it's just my kids that are left.
Yeah.
Right? So yeah. He's just got his kids, no one else's. And, you know, I think you bring up a good point, and I think it's, you know, important to bring back up. When the warrant is initially drafted, right, for the ATF to serve, a big part of it that allows the warrant to be written in the first place is the fact of, hey, we think that there are kids that are in danger here.
Right, right.
Which is separate and distinct from the actual aspects of the warrant,
right,
that allow the ATF to make to act on the situation. So it's just weird. I don't get it.
Well, Koresh jumps on that and he sets out a video of the kids that are still in the compound. He takes the whole movie inside. Hey, I'm David Koresh. This is my son, Cyrus. They're waving at the camera. They're saying hi. These kids don't look in trouble.
Right. They're not smiling, certainly.
No, actually, they kind of are, some of them.
Really?
Like, they look pretty happy.
They're there. They're living.
And he gets that message out. And the FBI is like, crap, what do we do with this?
Yeah.
They have a major debate. Because if you release it, it doesn't make him look like the monster you want him to be.
Yeah.
But it is sort of an honest rebuttal. You've used video of the kids who have already come out playing and doing all this stuff. That's crazy too, because these first kids who come out, they send them to an orphanage that's run by a different religion.
Yeah.
Okay. It's still a Christian religion, but they have a different belief system. And I know the FBI is thinking, well, this is going to make it easier and he's going to see that they're being taken care of. And Koresh and everybody just sees that and go, oh, great, they're brainwashing our children.
Right. It's I think the most direct threat you can have
right.
to Koresh's beliefs is we're gonna, you know, while we still have guns pointed at your house, we're gonna unteach the things you've taught to your children.
Right.
Which regardless of objectively, we can say precious beliefs, you know, bad, weird, whatever you want to think, right? Either way, it's going to piss him off.
And you've done this thinking it's going to make it better. You do not know him and his system well enough to understand that that's probably the worst thing you could have.
Yeah. I wouldn't even say it's a Band-Aid to a bullet hole. I would say it's just like salt or another right. bullet hole next to the first one.
And I don't think the FBI did that maliciously at all. They legitimately think this is a good thing. Who would think it's not a good thing? Well, if you knew who you were talking to.
Yeah, exactly. If
you might have realized he's not going to dig that.
If you listen to your negotiators.
Right. right?
I don't know.
So they're also going to do something here that, I mean, as a person who's concerned about civil rights and stuff like that, here's my line. Mm-hmm. Like, whatever, you tried to serve a warrant, it went bad. You have a right to serve it. We've already covered that. Now they're going to start bringing in these tactical military vehicles to, quote, remove the other vehicles that are around the compound.
Which is so...
Okay, and they don't remove them. They're running over somebody's car with a tank.
Yeah.
This is friggin' America.
Uh-huh.
There is no just run over my truck with your tank. That's not a thing.
Yeah, there is no precedent that allows the FBI to be like, well, no, we've done this before, because they've never done that before.
Yeah.
Like, we've also... never done it since. Like, this is such a I don't even have the words.
And good news,
egregious.
When this starts, the negotiating team knows nothing about it.
Yep, it's just HRT stepping in and saying, well,
let's do the old end around, guys.
Get rid of their vehicles, well, get rid of their cars.
We got this tank and we gotta take it for a ride.
We're gonna run a trick play, guys. The old fumble rooski on three. So, and there's a phone call. Hey, you guys are out there running over my cars and stuff. That's my property. What are you guys doing out there? You know,
mm-hmm.
I'm paraphrasing.
Yeah, but it's pretty accurate.
He's accurately describing what's happening
mm-hmm.
and pretty calmly saying that's bullcrap.
Yeah.
And you got the negotiator going, I don't know anything about that. Nobody talked to us.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't help.
Right.
And the fact that you don't know about it means you can't be trusted.
Yeah. So I think this is another moment of, like, the FBI has the Davidians all wrong, right? Because even when the FBI makes an active, pushing in tanks to go in and destroy Davidian property, they don't start shooting, right?
Right.
If they're actually these insane people who are just locked up inside of a building, you know, molesting kids every night and, you know, doing demon ritual sacrifices in the basement.
Where's my goat leggings?
Yeah, they probably would have started shooting, right? But instead, all they get is a phone call from a man who's confused, and he's like, what's happening here? And then he gets the mixed message response where the negotiators are saying, oh, we didn't know that was going to happen, right? And even then, he still is willing to engage in negotiations to an extent. But this is definitely a moment where that relationship has been, I think, irreparably harmed.
Hey, guess what you can see from 2 miles away on the grandstands?
A tank running over some cars.
You see a tank running over some cars.
Yep.
Okay? So this is a moment that all of America gets to see. This is what your government will do to you.
Yeah.
Okay? And are they like, hey, we just need to check the pink slips? If it's David Koresh's car, we can run it over. If it's David Thibodeau's car, we need to wave off that one.
Yeah.
No,
they're just running over everything there.
And I'm sure they're having fun.
And doesn't he, Koresh, I mean, this is, it's such a small fact that it doesn't matter anything. But he has like a nice like Camaro or something, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And he just has a pretty sick
car. That's a cool car.
But they're just going to go and run over it. Like, it's petty. Yeah. To me, the definition of petty. Like, there's...
But they wouldn't have done that to no dang Mustang.
Exactly. So,
yeah, it's 100% petty. And the people doing it in the tank, running over... Yeah, they were shooting at us when we did that. Okay, number one. So, you a-hole.
Yeah.
Don't run over my stuff in a tank.
Right.
If I shoot at you in your tank, I know I'm not going to hurt you, but you know I'm mad.
Right.
I'm cool with that. But, and then they... The weirdness is coming. So they're going to decide now.
Hasn't been weird, but yeah.
We're going to cut the power for good.
Yeah.
Okay? We're going to start dragging in the searchlights at night.
Mm-hmm.
under the premise that we're going to get you sleep deprived, because that's going to make you want to make better decisions.
Right. It's going to make you, you know, rational, and just overnight, as soon as the power's gone, David Koresh is going to wake up the next morning. He's going to say, oh, I see the error in my ways. I apologize humbly. That's not how humans work, FBI. This is your whole job, right? Is to understand, especially in a hostage situation, if you got HRT teams there, like the FBI should have had more foresight on human nature than...
Like any?
Yeah, exactly. Like literally just any common sense.
Because this isn't religious-based. This is just... What? How's that going to help?
Yeah, this is just incompetence.
In fact, you actually are attacking them and classifying them as a cult because they do things like Koresh gives all-night Bible sermons and they're sleep-deprived. Okay, pot calling the kettle black.
Yeah.
So you're going to come in and try and keep them up all night. And when Koresh complains about this stuff, first of all, if you're inside a building and you've already got curtains and crap on the walls because you're worried about getting shot, if somebody shines a big, bright light on them, you just get underneath it or to the side. It's a minor inconvenience at best, a minor annoyance.
But still annoying.
Yeah.
Right? Like, even if it doesn't have the effect, I think there is still this sort of greater message that's delivered to the Davidians of, like, the FBI wants to control every aspect of their lives while they're still within... Mount Carmel.
And we are willing to go back to 8th grade behavior to do it.
Yeah.
It's like you can hear all the things that they would just be talking trash with. Like, oh, you got your lights out.
Ooh, look at you. And then on the 15th, we get, and this is great, from above, not the negotiators, okay, but from above, the decision is made when we negotiate with Koresh, we are not going to listen to any more Bible babble.
Bible babble.
Okay, that's their words. Bible babble.
I mean, the first word that comes to my mind is childish, but I mean, the more effective word that I would use is, I mean, this is just ineffective language. This is ineffective communication to sort of broadly categorize all of Koresh's beliefs into this one two-word phrase that a literal newborn could say, right? Bible babble. Like, it's so dumb to me.
Hey.
And so negotiations from this point on...
They're not real. You might as well have just said, well, we're not going to negotiate with you because we think you're a religious freak.
Right.
That's what you said. But as a regular human being, like, let's say you heard this and you were any kind of religious Christian domination. Pick one. Doesn't matter.
Yep.
If you hear that the government's not going to negotiate with you because of your Bible babble... You just offended the majority of America.
Yeah, you...
And I mean, among them, you know, certain people who bomb government buildings in a year or two. Like,
yeah,
dumb policy.
And
you start trading negotiators at this point, too.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're throwing their hands up like, what the crap? You're not letting me do my job.
Yeah.
They're actively getting overruled, and that balance of power is never coming back to them. It is just going to keep drifting towards HRT. Mm-hmm. So if you are an FBI negotiator who's been told you've got precedence and all this, now you don't trust the FBI either. Mm-hmm. Why the heck should Koresh, right?
Yep, absolutely. Like, this is, you know, just every single day that this goes on, right, there is moments where there is, you know, just these little nuggets of hope where we can see, oh, okay, people are getting released, whatever. But then... the FBI, over the next week or so, just completely starts to renege on that progress by making antithetical decisions.
And then they're going to follow up with this. They're going to bring in loudspeakers, first time loudspeakers come in. And after we've run over your cars and accused you of Bible babble and shined lights in your room all night for a couple days.
And took away power.
With the loudspeakers, we're calling for you to come out, and we promise we'll treat you fairly.
I wonder...
who would believe that?
Who thought that would work, too? Yeah. Right? Like, who sat down and said, oh, I got them. We'll tell them that they're safe with us.
Well, for real, is there a point where in this whole thing... we are no longer trying to actually resolve this. We're actively trying to push any button we can to give us an excuse to go. We're just trying to make them react violently. Yes. You see it all the time on police videos. Mm-hmm. Cops needle you near you, and then you say or do the wrong thing, and bam, you're in cuffs and in the back of a car.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
So I think, like, legitimately, at some point around here, their only purpose is to find the excuse so they can go.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Which must be great for the negotiating team that's still there, and they're still trying to ask them to do stuff, and they're still blaming them. Yep. You guys haven't solved this thing in 3 weeks. This is your fault. Mm-hmm. They're having literal fights over this stuff in their command meetings.
And, I mean, sidebar, do we know, like... does the media know about this infighting that's going on? Or is this just something that we sort of learn about later on?
A lot of it we learn about later on. They do not put the negotiator... You've got the FBI, you know, head guy there, mm-hmm. right? They don't put the negotiator up on the press conferences.
Yeah, that's true.
They don't really put the HRT guy up on the... They put the head guy.
The news.
Show an image that this is somehow a coordinated effort or whatever.
Well, and the news is loving this. They're eating it up, because if it were just a standoff, it'd be boring.
For real.
People wouldn't really
care. Yeah, they'd go home. No, but there's nothing to see
there's
here.
So much, there's been so much happening and so much to watch that now there's just all this scrutiny falling down on the FBI now. And it really feels like the FBI is just squirming. They're scrambling for anything to get this to come to a conclusion.
Absolutely.
Which is only leading to more mistakes, and the media is just eating it up. Yep. They love it.
It's more and more of a spectacle as each day goes on.
So a couple mm-hmm. years before, we have the Gulf War, the first one, mm-hmm. okay? And Schwarzkopf is up there giving his daily briefings, and we're kicking butt every day. So he's reporting and laying it down, and he's a freaking... Schwarzkopf was the most... cool guy on Earth for about 10 days.
Right?
He was a superhero. His name sounds almost like Schwarzenegger, too. It was the whole thing. But I think that was the model the FBI is trying to have for their news conferences. We're going to put this up. We're going to show what we did. Da-da-da-da-da. I'm going to be good. I'm the guy in charge. I'm going to get good press. The FBI is going to look great. I'm going to get promoted. Hoorah, team.
Yep.
But instead of that, you've got this disjointed, you've got everybody asking all these questions that you don't know the answer to or won't answer.
Because it's too embarrassing. Yep.
And you're getting, it's got to be an absolute dread. I'm sure Schwarzkopf couldn't wait to get to the next news conference because he was going to go up there and put on a show.
Yeah, exactly.
But these guys, it's got to be like, frick, I got to go up there again. They're going to kill me. They're going to crucify me.
Yep.
I look stupid every day. And he's not wrong. Okay, March 19th, two adult Davidians leave. Another one leaves the 20th. Like, for real. Even after all this crap, people are still coming out.
Yep.
So you should consider this a success.
Negotiations have made definitive progress.
And stupidity has not.
Yeah.
Because every time you do something stupid, Koresh just waits.
Yep.
Okay, then on March 21st, five adult women come out. One more adult man comes out. All right? Nobody else is ever coming out. Mm-hmm. There's no way you know that then. But on March 21st, you've just had another sizable group of people. There's 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 people have left in the last 3 days.
Yep.
In spite of your nonsense, I've got to think that the FBI HRT side has gone, see, our crap works. All that pressure made them send people out.
Yep.
I'll bet everything on it.
Yeah, I mean, there has to be... I mean, with how simple-minded they clearly are with the decisions that they're making, I mean, it has to be that they draw these correlative conclusions, right? Oh, yep. We're doing a thing and progress is happening. Clearly what we're doing is working, when in reality, it's anything but.
So then we've got the... they start playing the music and the weird sounds on the loudspeakers all night.
Which is... This is weird.
We got Nancy Sinatra over and over. These boots are made for walking. It's an okay song. It's the Rick Roll of its day.
Yeah. But
tokenly annoying, childish.
Over and over and over. And while you're trying to sleep. Yep. You've got kids trying to sleep. Everyone is stressed. Koresh is still bleeding. But
hey, all your
Sinatra's in the background.
All your people on site, they get to hear that crap too.
Yeah.
Oh, you're punishing everybody. They're playing sounds of rabbits getting murdered. Mm-hmm. I don't know why you kill a rabbit, right? To eat it or whatever.
Right. Yeah.
But sounds of dying rabbits or sheep or something. They're playing Tibetan monks chanting. You know, normally that would not be anything that might be relaxing, except you've interjected a different religion again.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know if you meant to, but it's hard for me to believe all this stuff's accidentally stupid at this point. I think you're making choices designed to be annoying.
Yeah.
So they stopped negotiating. Koresh isn't going to talk to anybody. And then they get this great idea, right? The FBI, during the news conferences, starts telling everybody that Koresh is a liar and a coward. So now they're calling him out, and somehow, shockingly, he gets wind of this. And it doesn't help with negotiations. I don't understand. I just don't get it.
And so it's important to note there, so the guy, I don't remember his exact position, but there's one major player on the FBI side. His last name is Jamar.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So Jamar is, from what I have read, is sort of one of these big shot callers.
And oh, yeah.
Especially in the back half of the Waco siege, a lot of these decisions can be attributed to him.
But
especially things like noise over the loudspeaker and directly challenging Koresh's control, mm-hmm. right? Those are Jamar's ideas, and he proudly claims them as his, right? And his theory is, oh, well, we want to do these things to increase stress.
Because that'll right? help.
He actively wants to make them more stressed, which is just the fact that he said those words out loud and the FBI didn't fire him on the spot,
right.
I think speaks to the fact that there was a fundamental issue with the FBI.
Yeah.
Right? It goes beyond just the people that they had working there. But either way...
And his name is spelt Jamar, but pronounced dumbass. What a freaking loser this guy is.
Good one.
Sorry if you're his kid or grandkid. Not my... And I got messed up people in my family tree, too. Deal with it. Anyway... So yeah, it's going off the rails here. And we're at the end of the month. We're at the end of March, okay? And things are getting ratcheted up. They finally decide, I don't know why, to release that tape to the media of the kids inside the thing.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what their point is then. Like, you're showing that they're okay, they seem happy.
You just called
them
a liar.
Yeah, so I don't know why they decided to do it then. While all this is going on, Janet Reno's new...
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so she's new. She's the Attorney General.
Attorney General, yeah.
So she gets
tapped by
last say on everything legal that has to do with the U.S. government.
Yeah, she gets tapped by Clinton to come up, take the reins. She's one of the first female attorney. I don't know if she's the first, but one of the first Attorney Generals that we've had in this country. And she, you know, when she comes into office, there's a lot of hope around her.
Yeah, like
she's riding in on. She's coming into a good situation, and then one of the first things that she gets to take care of is Waco. So.
And you know what? She's kind of got a reputation like Margaret Thatcher. She's tough but fair.
Right.
And, hey, that's cool.
Logical, not, you know, especially with how, you know, sexist media in just this country was at the time, right? Reno is, in much of the same way that Thatcher was, she's seen as sort of a manly woman.
Unfortunately, yeah.
And all of its awful pretenses. But...
And in the day, like, I hated Janet Reno in the day. And as I've gotten older, and dear heavens, and heard more about the whole story and what was going on behind the scenes, at least as it's relating to Waco, I really feel like she just got duped by a bunch of men.
Yep.
Maybe not because they were men, because they were going to try and dupe whoever was in the chair.
I think them being men.
But I think they took advantage of her newness more than anything, and convinced her that they knew what the heck they were doing when that's probably not got the best goals in mind for people.
Because immediately as she comes in, we know now that Reno was not getting the full picture, right? She's getting information. She's not getting raw information from the scene. She's getting the sort of...
Filtered,
compressed, pretty... written out thing that you can put into a single document, slide it onto her desk so she can make a decision and then go on with her day. So, a lot of the decisions that occur from Reno, you know, it's hard to hold her 100% accountable.
Yeah, garbage in, garbage out, man.
Because she, there's so much evidence that shows how she was meticulous when she's reading through everything, and how the FBI brings her a plan. She says, no, I need more information.
And she questions specifics.
She asks for specific information. She asks specific questions. She's not willing to just sort of go gung-ho, hey, let's run over their cars, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's, you know, I wish that she would just been able to just walk onto the scene, right? Just once.
Yeah.
Because then I feel like there would have been a different outcome here.
Yeah.
Right? But fortunately, so, that doesn't happen.
To her credit, on March 31st, she holds a meeting with all the leaders of various stuff and is like, what's all the infighting?
Yep.
Like, we need to be on the same page here.
Yeah, negotiations, so, HRT.
Kudos for that, but the damage is done. The sides are picked. The die is cast on this thing.
And, you know, we just continue, for some reason, even after that meeting, right, the tactical decision-making just comes further and further into play.
Yeah, and you just start ignoring the negotiating side outright.
Yep.
And they're just as defeated as could be over the whole thing. So they have this meeting, the negotiators are trying, and they get Davidian, they get Koresh to say he agrees that, hey, he wants to do Passover with his church.
Mm-hmm.
After Passover, and so he'll come out with everybody.
Right, and it was his the state-appointed lawyers, DeGaron and Zimmerman, that go in.
And actually goes in, which is rare.
Right.
So super rare.
These lawyers walk in, go and, like, actually sit down in Mount Carmel for hours, and then they come out and they tell the FBI, all right, they're coming out.
Hey, crazy that something happened when you made it.
Yeah, you go in and talk
real,
to them.
Real, personal.
Treat them like humans.
Weird.
So that they're, like, smart and stuff, instead of just assuming that they're, you know, doing all of the things that we've made fun of before. Like, I don't know. This is just, it's another point where negotiations, it's another nugget of hope for me.
And it's rare, but in Ruby Ridge, Bo Greitz goes up there and volunteers to go in because he's kind of hero of the far right or whatever.
Right.
And, you know, they plug their nose and let him go in there. He walks out with Weaver.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that happened. So I don't know why the lesson is maybe we need to do something different, because how come everybody else can negotiate with these people, but we can't?
Right.
You know, I'd like to think that that's the lesson they have today. I guess we'll see the next time there's a big thing like this.
I don't know, man.
But who knows? So,
Passover,
Passover. Passover. All the nonsense keeps continuing. And then Koresh won't say, okay, this is the date and time I'm coming out. They're ready. They got, like, the ambulances lined up.
Mm-hmm.
They got the trucks. They're like, hey, here's Passover. Mm-hmm. What time are you coming out? 11:59, 8 o'clock. It's better if it's daylight. It's safer.
Right.
And they're all on board this train.
But somewhere between the beginning of the month and Passover, right, Koresh changes his mind?
Yeah.
You know?
Well, God tells him to wait.
Right. Oh, yeah. God tells him to wait because of the seven seals. But
and the FBI is quick to point out, you're a liar. You said you were coming out. Like, dude actually believes God told him, that line about you're a liar ain't going to help.
Yeah. And I think it's also important to note that even after the lawyers come out and the Davidians have agreed to come out after Passover, right, the FBI, they still are doing the lights.
They're still doing their nonsense.
Doing all of that at night. So it's not surprising to me that Passover passes without, you know, anyone coming out.
Yeah.
Like, I don't find that surprising in the slightest. I wouldn't trust the FBI.
So let's
go. I don't trust the FBI now.
I do. They're great. Good job, guys.
All right. Take your camo hat and go to bed.
I might need them to not charge me someday. I don't know.
Are you planning any big crimes?
Fifth Amendment? No comment. Okay. April 9th. I think this is another watershed date.
Mm-hmm.
Koresh sends out a letter.
The letter.
Yeah. And several people look at the letter and try and analyze the letter. And I'm not talking about what does this letter say. It's the whole what does this letter actually mean.
So I'm fascinated by this letter, mostly because we've never seen it. The FBI,
that's true.
Didn't
it get lost?
Something like that. The FBI to this day refuses to release it. And yet the FBI makes a lot of grandiose claims about Koresh's mental state because of this letter.
Yes.
Right? The FBI, from this point, they say, we have all of these professionals come in and talk about...
he's crazy.
Yeah, they come to the conclusion that he's crazy.
He's psychotic. He's never going to leave.
Right, and then he signs the letter as Yahweh Koresh.
Oh, he upgraded.
Right? So he changes
his
name.
He was David. He's Jesus now.
Yeah, he's you know, Jesus Cyprus. It's and in that letter, what we do know is that he cites six different points in the Bible. And these points in the Bible, the FBI interpreters kind of come to the conclusion that, oh, he's dangerous, right? Koresh is not in his right mind, and he means to do harm to the FBI, right?
Right.
That's how this letter is spun to the public.
Yes.
And we have no way of understanding if it's factual, if it's accurate or not.
I mean, what's it hurt at this point?
Yeah. I mean, it's just, you know, I want more than anything to read this letter.
Like the Zodiac Killer puts a letter out, and they publish that for anybody to try and decipher. But here we are after the fact, and we can't get this letter.
And I find it...
I'm going to go put a FOIA request in right now.
It's suspicious. it's so suspicious to me, because it feels like, you know, this letter is the point where the FBI absolutely decides, okay, he's not only dangerous... He's not in his right mind. So from this point on, negotiations. Pfft.
Yeah, now we're just, I need somebody to sign off that we can go, and we're going.
Yep.
So, and that's how it looks on the ground.
This is, you know, April 9th is, I think, kind of one of the final nails in the coffin.
A couple days later on the 12th, Justice and the FBI pitched the tear gas plan.
Oh, boy.
To Janet Reno. Who questions?
She asks.
She says, why do we need to do this?
And why
now?
Yeah. Why are we doing this at all? Why is tear gas necessary? But she asks, why are we doing this now? Right?
The waiting's
she says,
kind of been working.
Yeah,
right?
why not wait? We've had plenty of time, and there is progress that has been made with time. So what has changed? And the FBI, they don't have an answer.
Well, they come back with an answer, and it's 100% framed as the kids.
Yep.
They didn't have that at their ready, but after they got politely shut down for the moment, that was their rebuttal.
Right.
The kids. Which it's hard to argue against the kids. That's a tough fight.
Yeah. But it's...
The only kids in there now are his kids, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, you know, just gas them.
I mean, if they cared so much about the kids, maybe let the kids, like, sleep?
Right?
I don't know. Something neurological development, something. Trauma, something. I guess this is the 90s. We don't care about mental health yet.
Okay, 13th, Clinton gets notified.
Oh,
and they want to do this gas plan. And he says, I'm not mad at this, okay? I have mixed feelings. He says, he hands it back to Reno and is like, this is your baby.
This is your decision.
You make the decision.
And it's, like, Clinton and Reno, from what I've read, like, when they meet to talk about Waco, they talk for hours. Right, it's a long drawn out process where Clinton is asking Reno questions. Reno probably most of the time is like, I don't really know, but you know they come to the conclusion where Clinton is like, I don't like this situation. Right, something smells bad, but ultimately Reno, your choice.
Okay,
and so yeah, I mean,
I think it's cool that you pick people, put them in charge. Trust them enough to make decisions.
Yeah.
But ultimately, if you're an upper-level commander, at some point, if your gut's in it that you think it's wrong, you need to interject. So my assumption is Clinton, based on what he heard, doesn't have a beef with it and is comfortable handing that back down either way.
Yep.
That's the only... And I'm not mad at that. I think...
I'm not either. I think it makes sense, you know, because where Reno has a lot on her plate as Attorney General and Waco... kind of just has to be a thing that she's worried about.
Right.
Waco is probably even less of a focus for someone like Clinton, right? Being in the president's office, the information he's getting, you know, all the priorities that he has.
Well, soon enough, he'll have a lot of focus on Monica Lewinsky. But That's not yet.
He's still a good man at this point. In the eyes of the world.
I'm not going to judge him as a bad man over one alleged continuous incident.
Okay, you'd be the only conservative to not.
Hey, okay, for the record, Clinton took a beating for that, right? You don't need to impeach him for it. That was overkill. when you get mad as a conservative for Trump getting impeached, you kind of set the precedent to pick on some little stuff. You did it first.
I am proud of you.
See, he's a progressive.
I'm not a progressive. No. But I'm a realist. I'm a realist. If you're going to use it, expect it to get used on you.
That's fair. I agree. Anyway, that's besides the point. So about Waco.
Okay, so we get done with that. And now it's like, okay, Reno's basically going to sign off on it and hand over that decision-making power to the people in the field.
Right.
I trust you. My boss trusted me. Do what you think is best.
Yeah, and
4 seconds later...
So this gets handed back. Reno decides, all right, fine. If you feel the tear gas is necessary, I wish I could remember. But, you know, Reno, again, she's getting misinformation as far as what the actual what's the urgency. And whoever from HRT went and talked to Reno, they must have a silver tongue able to spin gold, right? Because she's asking the questions.
I heard the same thing was said once about Monica. Never
mind. You you know,
we just got a PG-13 for this episode. My bad.
Whoever is able to convince her that there's urgency here, there is a deadline where at some point, if we don't act now, something worse is going to happen. And, you know, there's just no reason to believe that that's true. Right?
Well, but did I tell you this last time? I can't remember. And all the little nuggets last night was my nugget episode.
Okay.
There is a required training that the HRT team is supposed to be at coming up. And if they're stuck at Mount Carmel, they're not going to make their deadline for this training.
Oh, my God.
And the commanders do not want them to risk losing this training opportunity because they're sitting around doing nothing in Texas.
Yeah, God forbid they do their job.
For real, that's a thing. That's real.
Oh, my gosh. The incompetence. The incompetence, the impatience, and the audacity. That's just...
None of which means that the Davidians were right in what they did. But
no.
There's plenty of nonsense blame to go around.
But at this point, who can straight face say the FBI did the right thing? Is actively do anyway.
Not me.
So Reno decides, all right, fine. Do what you see fit.
And we don't know exactly when that happened. There's a date range, a couple days. Mm-hmm. And the go day ends up being April 19th. And they're going to go out at 5:59 in the morning. Thank you, sleep deprivation.
Yeah.
To announce to everyone that they're now under arrest and they have to come out right now. Or they're going to gas the place.
I want to point out, when they served the warrant, originally it wasn't until like 9 or 10 in the morning.
Well, you know.
But now.
Now we can
serious.
Hear 6 in the morning. Yeah. Well, the FBI is not like that, ATF.
Oh, yeah.
They're on the schedule.
That's on the schedule.
They don't got to get their coffee first.
And so it turns out that when all the speakers say, hey, you're all under arrest now, it turns out nobody came out under arrest.
No one cares. Yeah. They know you're there. They know why you're there. So April 19th begins with a dud.
Every single person who did come out who was an adult went to jail. At least first. A few of them ended up released later on, but they all ended up arrested first.
Yep.
And originally, they were all tried with murder for the 4 dead ATF agents.
Seriously?
Man.
Yes. That's... Anybody who was an adult who walked out of there was charged with murder, and if they found a reason to let you off later, they did.
The audacity.
Jeez.
Because obviously, they all shot those 4 people.
Oh, yeah. Obviously. Yeah. They were all just holding one really big gun.
Well, they did have some 50s. Anyway. And now they start gassing the place.
Yeah, so at 6 a.m. they start gassing, which this is kind of the first, at least, misconception that I see out there. Or at least not misconception, but I guess one of the first, like, what am I trying to say? Oh, so one of the things that I hear a lot when people talk about Waco is, oh, they started tear gassing and then the fire started.
Yes.
Which, those two things go hand in hand, in a way, But
that's started, that's fire started 6:02, right?
It starts six hours. They start gassing at 6 a.m. and, you know, the fire doesn't start until 6 hours later.
Right. It's a lunch barbecue.
And so this gas has time to sit inside the house. So they send in Abrams tanks to go in with their booms.
Uh-huh. Especially, out, like, constructed.
Knock out windows, knock holes in the wall. In what Reno was told would be a very, like, specific manner, right? We're told now that there is a plan where the HRT said, okay, we're going to knock out this wall section, we're going to knock out this window, and we're going to leave this exit route,
and
right?
And then the news shows.
Right, and then once they actually start going and doing it, the booms are, like, knocking out major
entire
sections
zones.
Of wall.
Yeah.
We see parts of the roof start to collapse. They're not just knocking out windows, but they're tearing entire sections. There's one part where the boom goes, knocks out the window, and then the tank just kind of keeps going.
Like, into the house.
Like, into the house. So who knows what kind of internal damage happened
right,
when they
right.
actually started sticking this boom in there.
And you have a couple choices at that point. You could go, whoa, this is falling apart.
Yeah.
Literally,
this,
physically,
this isn't
much
going
faster
to, this isn't
than
going
we
plan.
Predicted. Our plan was not to do this for 48 hours. Let's pull back and just, you know, use all the ferret rounds and get the gas in different ways.
Yeah.
That was not what happened.
Right. They didn't do that, which
or
weird.
You
that they
double down.
And yeah. I'll tell you, how's the news feel once we start running tanks into buildings?
Dude, they love it. Pretty much anytime someone jumps in the tank, the news gets all giddy.
Right.
They freak out because they know something's going to go down.
And so for...
There's nothing else on TV at that point until the fire.
Yeah. Right.
Because there's a tank going through a church.
Yep.
That's your headline, kids.
Yep. Yeah. So... For this starts happening at 6 a.m. I'm sure the news, right, there is time for cycles and cycles and cycles happen. And stories, you know, as they do with time, stories will kind of build on top of each other.
Yes.
So before the fire has even happened, everyone knows that something's happening at Mount Carmel.
Yep.
Right? People are tuned in. They are waiting to see what's going to happen.
It is 100% like when that second plane hits on 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody saw the first plane hit.
Everyone saw the second.
Everyone on Earth saw that second plane hit.
Yep.
And when that fire erupts at Waco right after noon, everyone in America who has a TV is watching it.
Yep.
It is the story. And you didn't hear about it and tune into it. You were already watching.
Yep. Yeah. So the fire itself is kind of the last big question mark. Because we don't know 100% what started the fires, right? However, I went back and I read the arson investigation that occurs about a week after Waco happens, because they have to wait for there's some quote that Waco was still hot until a week later.
Yeah, there's still live ammunition and it's hot enough they're literally, you know, legitimately
right.
concerned.
And so the arson investigation concludes that there's three distinct fires that start inside of Mount Carmel, and they all start within 4 minutes of each other.
Yes.
And then 7 minutes later, the arson investigation just says
it's all engulfed.
The fire has spread, right?
Yeah.
So there is also an audio recording where you can hear people inside of Mount Carmel talking about, we should get more gasoline. Do you want me to pour this gasoline?
Right.
We need to throw more hay in. So I think there's enough evidence out there to conclude that yes, the fire was started by some way by the Davidians.
I agree.
The initial fire itself, right? But then how the fire spread so fast? Well, the arson investigation talks about how, well, Mount Carmel wasn't built properly. There wasn't actual like safety measures that were put
right.
in place, just kind of this ramshackle hut that's slapped together for people to go to church in. And so they say that's the reason why the fire spreads. But to me, the amount of CS gas that they have put inside of the building, we know that CS gas is flammable. That's
yes.
a fact.
Yes.
So I think, you know, if the tear gas wasn't there and they had started the fire, there probably is enough time for people to get out. Right.
Well, and you brought up the arson report. I have it up on the screen here.
Mm-hmm.
Well, another thing in that arson report is they talk about how the wind, the outside winds, had little to do with the spread of the fire because of the way the building was. It wouldn't have had that big of an effect. But if that's true, then that means those outside winds aren't going to have much of an effect on dissipating the gases
either. Yeah, exactly.
You have to have both. It can't be one or the other.
And it's important to note, they don't just gas the house once, right? They start gassing at 6 a.m. and by 6:30, they say, oh, the house is full of gas, but then no one's really coming out because we know now they had gas masks inside of Mount Carmel, right? So over the span of 6 hours, they're putting more and more and more gas in. And granted, right, the tanks with the booms were knocking massive holes in the walls, right? Yes. They were causing a
structural
lot of damage.
Damage.
So there was some amount of dissipation, but there just is this condensed, you know,
leftover.
It's just a house full of fuel.
Propellant in the air and aerosol and
there is so
gasoline
much that
and whatever.
Can go wrong. And unfortunately, you know, however you want to believe the fire starts, the fire started.
Yes.
I think the thing to be mad about is just that there was a situation where someone felt the need to start a fire in the first place.
Right.
Right. Like this whole thing could have been avoided a month and a half earlier.
Because at that point, you know, if the and I agree with you, I believe the Davidian started these three fires. Mm-hmm. I think everything else that went on made it worse.
There's no way to believe that it's either.
You've put people in a position where they feel like that's their best out, their only out.
Yeah.
They could have done that on day one if that was their goal. Mm-hmm. So you've kind of pushed them into there.
Yeah. And so obviously the fire happens. And once they're actually able to get into Waco, or once they're actually able to get into the ruins of Mount Carmel, right? They're counting bodies. There's some 70 some odd people that are dead.
I think we end on the fire.
Okay.
Because the aftermath, the investigations, what they find for guns, what they find for people, what they find for those people's cause of death, because that's going to lead to some of the controversy too.
Yep.
Let's put all that on for episode 4, apparently.
All right.
And I think 4 we might actually be able to finish, possibly. Maybe.
We'll see.
So, parting shots, final thoughts.
Waco is the FBI's biggest embarrassment. And I hope, you know, the next time that a hostage situation happens like this, the FBI is able to check its own ego. Right. I hope the FBI is able to look past itself because this was ridiculous.
I mean, this whole thing started because a UPS driver, some post office driver was, you know, delivering a box full of hand grenade shells. And now we got the whole thing going up in a blaze.
Well, and I'll end with this. If you think that this is the only time an American law enforcement entity has burned men, women, and children in a siege, wait for a future episode on MOVE in Philadelphia, because that one is much less known because it was smaller, but the victims were all people of color. I wonder if that makes a difference.
It couldn't be. Couldn't possibly be.
All right. Well, until next time, thanks for listening, and we'll see you then on History on the Dark Side. We'll be right back.